This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
On today's program, we're going to talk about the book, Addicted to War, Why the U.S. Can't Kick Militarism, a very interesting book that's done in cartoon form, but yet contains a lot of good quotes and good points to ponder. The publisher of that book, Mr. Frank Dorrell, will be talking to us in our second segment today. In our third segment, we're going to get around to discussing the very interesting appearance by one of America's premier scientists here in Davis at the Mondavi Center, Edward O. Wilson. That in our third segment. I'd like to start out by thanking once again Vicki and Bill Wilson, who appeared on last week's program and told their compelling and heart-rending story about having to receive a late term in the eighth month abortion in 1994. If you'd like to hear more about that story, I would recommend that you go to www.salon.com and find Vicki's article written in June of 2000, which goes over much of the same information we talked about, but gives you some additional details that I think are perhaps worthwhile to clarify. Personally, I don't see how anybody could hear Vicki and Bill's story and not feel a bit uneasy about the fact that in the United States we are about to pass a law that will ban the kind of procedure that certainly reduced the risk to Vicki's life, perhaps saved her life, and ended their daughter's suffering. In the coming months, we will be bringing on some people from Planned Parenthood to talk a little bit more about some issues of birth control. We'll also be talking, I think, to Vicki again about issues of adoption, and I'm looking forward to bringing that to you. Article from the Bee, Dateline May 10th. Doctor's killer gets 25 to life. Anti-abortion extremist cop says he'd do it again. Under the byline of Carolyn Thompson, Associated Press, Buffalo, New York, anti-abortion extremist James Kopp was sentenced to 25 years to life Friday for the sniper slaying of a doctor, declaring without a trace of remorse, "I wish I could do 10 life sentences or 10 death penalties to save the unborn." Kopp received the maximum for the 1998 murder of Dr. Barnett Slepian, 52, an obstetrician-gynecologist and father of four, who was cut down by a bullet that came through his kitchen window. Kopp apparently laid in wait with a rifle behind Slepian's suburban house, fired a single shot after the doctor returned from a memorial service for his father. Although defense attorneys argued that Kopp meant only to wound the doctor, prosecutors pointed out that his choice of weapons, a Russian-made scope-equipped assault rifle, and his use of aliases and buying it, pointed to an intent to kill. Now, I realize these are extremists on the anti-abortion side, but I've noticed that this sort of activity has not received the widespread censure that you think it would be due. At least that's in my opinion. It so happens that a friend of mine knew this Dr. Barnett Slepian, said he was actually quite a fine individual, and perhaps in a future installment of this program, we'll let him tell a bit about this man who was murdered by an anti-abortion extremist. Let us speak of cheerier things. Tonight, there is a lunar eclipse. The full moon will be rising at about 8 p.m. in the east to southeast sky, at which point it will be almost completely eclipsed. As it rises up, it'll reach the maximum totality of eclipse. It may appear a reddish-brown to rusty-brown. It's hard to say. Lunar eclipses vary quite a bit in appearance. One interesting thing about it is during eclipse, you sometimes get this 3D effect of the moon looking very much like a globe, more than it normally does so. And this is worth watching. I hope that you'll plan to be out somewhere facing east 2 hours after the show. Interestingly, this year we get two lunar eclipses. There'll be one in November, which I believe we will be in a little bit better situated to see. This one rising in eclipse, we're missing the effect of watching it slowly disappear or dim when it's higher in the sky. But the fact that it's rising in eclipse is kind of curious, and I'm going to go out there and watch it, and I hope you'll do the same. So Sometime this summer, we're planning a trip up to the mountains to take a look at the heavens, some astronomy, and we want to address the fact that the technology of amateur astronomy has just moved ahead by leaps and bounds in the past couple of decades, and what you can get for your money these days is pretty impressive. And when we do that, we'll probably talk about one of our pet peeves, light pollution. In a lot of your better bookstores, sometimes you'll see these maps taken from space of the planet. And one of the most amazing things about these photos of planet Earth is the amount of light streaming up into the heavens from the cities of, the industrial nations. And, you know, that's all wasted light. Illuminating the sky, the clouds, and, you know, the International Space Station is not necessarily a good use of all those kilowatts. Now, have you folks heard about Planet X? I had not heard about Planet X, this supposed Planet X, until a couple weeks ago when I got a call from a friend of mine in Tahoe saying, "What do you know about this thing?" I said, "Well, there's no Planet X. Pluto was Planet X." Once they discovered Pluto, they were looking for another planet, but they never found another planet in the solar system. What are you talking about? Well, I went on the web and discovered, in response to my friend's pleading to clear this matter up, that people out there believe that there is a planet which is sometime in the month of June, that's next month, going to make a very close flyby, I guess you'd call it, of planet Earth as it whips around the sun. This is based, strangely enough, upon a Babylonian relief in a museum, I believe, in Europe, which some interpret as showing 11 planets. This has been extrapolated into the fact that there must be a mysterious planet out there that, per some, let's just say, unusual mathematics, these people claim indicates it's going to whip past the Earth in June. Well, the Babylonians might have been some pretty decent naked eye astronomers, but I don't think they were really up to snuff on modern orbital calculations of planets. And anyway, the fact that they put an extra dot next to the sun on a relief is open to other interpretations. Now, comets do come whipping in. Halley's Comet is one of the famous examples into the inner solar system every so often. But it doesn't just come burning rubber out from, like, beyond Pluto into the region of the sun in, like, 4 weeks. That's just not going to happen, folks. Now, also here on KDVS, Michael Mercury has a show, I believe, a couple times a week, dedicated to things astrologic. Now, on this program, we have a somewhat different view. I don't, let's just say, necessarily subscribe to the viewpoint of people in the astrology realm. But I wanted to talk to Michael about this because, you know, he has an entertaining show. He has a public that listens to it. And by the way, I think that we need more out of the mainstream voices in contemporary radio. I think that you brought that here on KDVS, and that's a good thing. In this modern era of political correctness, I think that we just don't have enough dissent. And, again, Michael Mercury's demographics probably in this show's don't necessarily overlap a great deal. But, to quote Voltaire, although I may not agree with what someone says, I would or should defend to the death his right to say it. Although perhaps I can't presume to speak for Michael Mercury, I'm quite certain that if you call him on his show and ask him this, and I probably will do this myself, I think we can clear up from the astrologic and astronomer's point of view that we do not need to fear catastrophe here on Earth from a planet X. Now, there actually are some legitimate concerns about a so-called planet X, and actually it's very interesting science. We'll talk about that, I think, at some point in the future as well, but not today. Now, I understand over in Great Britain, there's an effort afoot to decriminalize marijuana. I'm not sure what the laws exactly are over in the UK, but apparently some people feel that whatever they are, they're too strong and they want to reduce the penalties. Now, this is being resisted by some people, and this story from MSNBC really caught my eye on May 2nd, claiming, based on a study done in a hospital in Great Britain, headline, "Smoking cannabis may be more dangerous than doctors had previously thought and could kill up to 30,000 people in Britain each year," scientists said. Very alarming headline, isn't it? So I turned to the text. Well, let me quote from it. Although they are inhaled differently, and the active ingredients in cannabis are not the same as those in tobacco, both produce harmful chemicals when smoked. Each year, tobacco causes about 120,000 deaths among Britain's 13 million smokers, with about 3.2 million cannabis smokers in the country. Professor John Henry of Imperial College London and colleagues at St. Mary's Hospital in the capital calculated the pot death toll could be 30,000. Quote, if cannabis caused the same number of deaths as tobacco, given the numbers of smokers, then you'd be seeing that number of deaths, Henry told Reuters. Now, do I need to point out what a huge if that is? Because the truth is, study after study after study done over the past few decades in effort to tie cannabis smoking to any sort of health problem consistently has failed to demonstrate a connection. I consulted a UC Davis pharmacologist on this matter who knows more about the subject than I do, and he said the studies have not been able to even show that loss of motivation and basically a lack of drive in heavy marijuana smokers can be associated. Now, I think almost everyone who's been familiar with heavy pot smokers would agree that that one is pretty easy to buy. And if they can't even prove that one, they're in trouble in finding a link between cannabis smoking and serious health problems. Now, a Doreen McIntyre was quoted in the article. McIntyre apparently organizes Britain's annual No Smoking Day. She dismissed this editorial as speculation and said there was no comparison between smoking the occasional joint and smoking dozens of cigarettes every day. I may not say no comparison, but I would have to agree that there's not much of a comparison between the two. And when I say that, you know, the scientific studies would back me up. In a related story I've been saving from February 25th, Chronicle staff writer Demian Bolwa, headline, U.S. raids firms selling items used by pot smokers, saying high times are over for those who sell pipes and bongs favored by pot smokers. Federal agents raided more than 100 homes and businesses throughout the nation, including a glass pipe company owned by actor-comedian Tommy Chong of Cheech and Chong fame. The raids stemmed from the indictments of 50 people, including six in Northern California, who faced federal charges of trafficking in illegal drug paraphernalia. I'm tempted to ask whether John Ashcroft doesn't have better things to do, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, perhaps this is good to keep him off the streets occupied with this. But, you know, this is not a good use of federal tax dollars. I'm sorry. The war in Iraq seems to have dropped out of the news like a rock, as Americans apparently are returning back to being concerned about what happened to Lacey Peterson, Michael Jackson's home movies, and what Britney Spears is wearing. It's perhaps somewhat encouraging that Americans are returning back to being concerned about pointless BS, but I really think the public is ill-served by not addressing what happened in Iraq. We're not going to let it go here on this program. All right, article, Washington Post, Peter Slevin, Dateline, Baghdad, Iraq, May 13th. Baghdad residents and U.S. officials said Monday that U.S. occupation forces are insufficient to maintain order in the Iraqi capital amid a wave of violence that has swept over the city, undermining relief and reconstruction efforts and inspiring anxiety. Fires burned anew in several government buildings and looting resumed at one of Saddam Hussein's palaces. Even traffic was affected as drivers ignored rules in the absence of Iraqi police, only to crash and cause tie-ups. I think some of this is explained by an April 28th article in Newsweek magazine by Jonathan Alter, actually a commentary by Mr. Alter, about the fact that as this war was raging, many people were saying that there weren't enough forces in Iraq. Apparently, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was very sensitive to this criticism and in a counterattack claimed that, no, we had the right number of people over there. You may remember in March when people like Barry McCaffrey and Wesley Clark were criticizing the war effort as being, you know, going in with insufficient strength. Well, Alter, in this article, says that he learned last week that many army officers wanted to airlift 3,000 military police from Europe to protect supply lines and police Baghdad. That would have aided the drive to the capital and help to protect institutions like hospitals and museums once forces arrived there. But Rumsfeld apparently decided no MPs. The European military police would have had to been replaced by reservists. And if more reservists had been called up in the middle of the war, it would have reinforced the criticism that Rumsfeld hadn't sent enough troops. Alter suggests that when the real history is written, we may find out that some of the world's oldest treasures were lost to looters in part because someone at the Pentagon suffers from the oldest of human sins, pride. Now, further breaking my heart over what happened to the Baghdad Museum, something we've devoted quite a bit of time to on this program, breaking my heart is an article that I had stashed in February from the Chronicle, titled, Idea of War Alarms Archaeologists. I just want to quote one paragraph from that article. Leading archaeologists and representatives of cultural groups have conferred with the state and defense departments, stressing the importance of compliance with the 1954 Hague Convention on the Protection of Cultural Property in the event of armed conflict. The treaty obliges combatants not to target cultural sites and monuments except where military installations have been placed on or next to. As we all know, this did not happen. The Baghdad Museum survived the war, but it did not survive the peace. There's a lot more to this story, and I want to hit it harder, but we have a lot of ground to cover today, so I'm going to defer that to next week when I'm going to bring to you some quotes from Robert Fisk, correspondent for the Independent newspaper in Britain, on what he himself saw in regards to what was going on with the looting and burning of ministries in Baghdad in the wake of the war. His firsthand accounts of what went on have not gotten much play here in the U.S. press, but we're going to do what we can to correct that deficiency. We're running out of time here, so I want to end this segment with some quotes from Molly Ivins. We quoted from Ivins' column 2 weeks ago on the show, and I'm really coming to appreciate what a fine writer Molly Ivins is. Article appearing on May 12th, Sunday, in newspapers around the country. Article titled, So Where Are Iraqis' Weapons of Mass Destruction? Press's Lack of Curiosity, Stunning. To quote briefly, the weirdest media reaction of all, and what's going on, is to the ongoing non-appearance of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. More and more stories quoting ever-unnamed administration officials appear saying the administration would be amazed if we found weapons-grade plutonium or uranium, and that finding large volumes of chemical or biological materials is unlikely. Look, she says, if there's no WMDs in Iraq, it means either our government lied to us in order to get us into an unnecessary war, or the government itself was disastrously misinformed by an incompetent intelligence apparatus. In either case, it's a terribly serious situation. She points out that it does matter if our government lies to us. Why do you think people were so angry at President Lyndon Johnson over the Gulf of Tonkin, President Nixon over the secret war in Cambodia, even at President Clinton over the less than cosmic matter of whether he had sex with that woman? If it makes no difference whether the government lied, why is Thomas Friedman a journalist? Friedman, of course, has said it doesn't really matter whether, you know, there were weapons of mass destruction or not. Regarding that attitude, Molly Ivins asks, why is Friedman a journalist? Why does journalism exist at all? Good question. I'm not a journalist by trade, but I think that journalism is supposed to exist to bring us information that we need. We're trying to do that here on this program, which is Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM. Let's take a short break and come back and talk to Frank Doral about the book, Addicted to War, Why the U.S. Can't Kick Militarism. I'm Douglas Everett.